conference is being recorded.
Yeah, look at the structure of the problem, and then go back to giving them problems where they use the same kind of skills in a context, and it seemed to work for them.
Yeah, there was actually, I know one of the ones that you might be thinking of, it was in the Journal of Mathematical Behavior in, like, the late 90s. It's Gerald Fast. The only reason that one's right at the top of my head is that I had him as an instructor for a master's class, and he used an instrument like that with pre-service teachers. He gave them some of, like, these conjunction tasks to begin with. And then he gave them a parallel task on a second test and then asked them to go back and, you know, decide if they would change their minds on any of the answers after working the analogous tasks. So that's one instance, and I think there probably are some other papers out there like that too.
Good. Thanks for putting a name to it. I think that is the paper I was thinking of.
Yeah, it was, he even had a name for it. It was like, the instrument was published with the paper. It's called What Do You Think the Chances Are? And there's like two versions of it that are like right in the appendix of that paper.
Good reference.
Yeah, I can, I'll dig up the reference for that one and send that out by email if anyone is interested in taking a look at it.
Yeah, I think making sure that at least gets in our notes for today, that would be good.
Yeah, I'll find it.
Well, and maybe that was what they were trying to do, because I thought it was kind of interesting, like on page 251 and 252, I thought it was so strange, because they were talking about doing this in context and getting away from sort of the dice and marble type of examples. And so they were talking about after the students completed the big splash, they assessed the students' understanding of sampling. And they were talking about the different sampling methods and I guess, you know, talking about asking half the children in each grade or asking, I guess the students had been standing in a line in this particular story. And then they said to evaluate students' grasp of the relationship between a sample and a population, they went back to, you know, a bag of marbles has 60 white marbles, 20 black marbles, and 20 red marbles. And so they went back to something that didn't really have context. And that jumped out at me as sort of strange, because they had sort of spent the last few pages talking about how different there was two different, they gave it two different names, like the inference setup and the chance setup or something.
You're talking about on page 241?
Yeah. They had talked about the two different ways of looking at, I have just lost it completely, talking about how students viewed those differently. I just died, 241. Yeah, sorry. Results and interpretation. Maybe that was it. Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't seem to find it right at this selection.
Weren't they talking a lot about how they had problems between the two? And so I thought maybe part of the goal of why they went back to that is they were trying to link them. If I remember correctly, they talked about something with like using the chips to recognize how much students would pay for a dunk tank kind of thing. So it kind of seemed like they were trying to go from the context to chips and then maybe trying to go back possibly.
Yeah, that was later on that they did that.
Well, I just remember reading, I can't remember where, but.
Yeah. I just thought that was an interesting choice, that they went back to the marble setup to evaluate students' grasp of the relationship between a sample and a population and a chance. I mean, maybe that was the point, is to go back to a chance setup and see how they did that. So, maybe I didn't quite understand what they were doing. That is always possible.
Other comments about this paper?
I think, I mean, this kind of it goes along with what you've been talking about, but I think it's interesting that, to me anyway, that the task, they talk about that, like the conjunction task starting out as kind of a means for assessing whether or not students have these normative patterns of statistical thinking, but then they suggest in this paper actually using some of those as, you know, as teaching tasks, which is kind of intriguing, I think, because originally the tasks were meant just like as assessment, but it kind of, you know, you can feed the assessment back in and see if it actually changes students' perception. So I thought that was an interesting part of the paper that would be kind of a neat thing to test out and really see, you know, taking some tasks that were meant as assessment like that and then kind of turning them on their head and trying to use them as teaching tools. It was, I thought, an interesting idea.
I just really doesn't have anything to do with anything research-based, but I love the quote when they were looking at students' responses to the random method, and one wrote, she might pull out all the first grade names, and the other wrote that the random selection method is too hard and is stupid. You want random kids. Like, I actually laughed out loud at that.
It's funny, but you really get interesting, like, little, I call them kind of like golden nuggets, when you conduct your research. And,
yeah.
I mean, I've got, particularly when you're working with students, and, they use natural language. They really, try to express themselves in the way they normally express themselves. And, I think lots of people have, video clips or, quotes that they use from kids that show the kind of nature of them being kids, but also trying to express themselves and what they think about the question or the concept that they've been asked to think about. And I know, and it's actually, I actually like whenever I get those kinds of things because I know that I can get a lot of mileage out of them. Those are the kinds of things that, when put in articles, people do laugh out loud at, but they help to deliver a point.
I have one thing that, I probably say this with almost every paper I read anymore, but on page 263 they were talking about the method, and it said the intervention took approximately 2 months to complete, and I have 4 entire months with my class. How on earth am I supposed to spend time on stuff trying to get these concepts down when, we have so much material we have to cover in the class, and how can you do it in a shorter time frame? Well,
I think there is a little bit of a difference because, they're talking about this is K through 12, this is what, 5th and 6th graders, and they have them for an entire year, and they have them for a lot more time than, we as college teachers have them for. We have them, I have mine for 3 hours a week for, 16 weeks, 15 weeks. So, I think something like this may be a little adventurous. I think that's the wrong word. But
I think it's pretty accurate, actually.
I mean, it seems amazing because it seems like even though this might have been younger students, our students kind of have the same problem.
Well, I think you can. I think you can, smaller scale it. I think they really were going through quite a lot with what they were trying to do here. Now, how you smaller scale it, I'm not exactly proposing anything, but I think you can, maybe just pick a part of this and...
Well, and researchers that work in K-12 classrooms, trust me, they and the teachers of the classroom have the same kind of issues and concerns. And even though it appears that they've got longer time with the students, they typically have more content to cover. As far as their curriculum and other demands on them. And so I think it's all a matter of scale. And so I think the amount of content that has to be covered in a college-level class, given the time, is probably about the same as that has to be covered in a in a grade level, given the time. They have end-of-year tests. I mean, there's lots of different constraints. And so I think it's just important when you think about trying to do stuff in whatever context you're in, you have to make choices, and you have to decide where you can get the most bang for your buck in some places, so that you could spend extended amount of time in another area. And it's no small task. Mm-hmm. The classes that have, and this is also true at the high school and the lower grade levels, when you're doing research in a course that is not necessarily a prerequisite or a building block for another course, you tend to have a little bit more freedom. Yeah. Because if you don't get to a particular concept, you know it's not necessarily going to kill them of not necessarily getting to it.
Yeah.
Designing research in real classrooms, whether it's at the college or high school, is challenging.
Yeah. I think that, the one thing that kind of stuck out to me with this article and then the next article, which was talking about the teaching experience, is how, trying to combine, this research method with also just a good lesson in teaching, where hopefully the students are addressing these issues and being able to figure them out rather than just trying to memorize everything we're saying, it all takes a lot of time. So good teaching takes a lot of time. Good research takes a lot of time. I think they're trying to combine them here, but it can feel a bit, mind-boggling at times. I think there was one quote that I really liked out of this article, though, where it talked about how the world should not serve as an example for applying an abstract mathematical principle. Rather, an abstract mathematical principle should serve as an example for how to model the world. And that really stuck out to me, probably more from a teaching standpoint than a research standpoint, but this idea of, letting them go through the discovery, letting them go through that process of discovery and misstep and reevaluation and everything that's involved with that on their own really is the better way to teach them. But it can be a very scary thing to do, I think, from a teacher's point of view, in terms of time and what we have to get all this content covered because I'm sending them off to another course or, this is what the syllabus says, whatever it is.
Well, it's also very hard to trust that they get where they need to go without you telling them exactly where it is they need to go, and part of that discovery-based idea is that, they do get there on their own and you don't have to, be with them every step of the way, and that, whatever you've designed, they will eventually figure it all out and they'll discover the different concepts, and that is hard to sort of let that part of it go and trust that, that you've done your job, just not in a different way than perhaps you've done it before. So, and hopefully, assess and see if they've gotten where they needed to go.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't have too much written down from this one. I had that I liked the on page 236 where they laid out all the broad lines of theorizing the culture of mathematics, the inert knowledge, the expertise. I just found that section very interesting. But the one question that I had from the whole article was they did a lot of interactive projects. There was a lot of scaffolding. There was a lot of feedback. How much of that do we still need at the college level? Like, how much scaffolding do you, how much building do you do during the semester? I was just curious. Hello?
Yeah, we're think we're still here.
No.
I think that's a good question, and part of me feels like, you know, I'm sure, and I'm not an expert on kind of cognitive psychology or learning science and development, but even if children reason differently than adults and pick things up differently than adults, I think there is a certain element of this is the first time they've seen these formal principles presented. And so there are always unique challenges that come with the first time you're seeing a subject. And there are some things, you know, one of the things we wrestle with in statistics is students are coming in with vague notions and proto-theories and all of this, and then we're trying to get them to formalize those notions, and there's problems that run up there. Because we're just trying to, you know, in the past it's been, we've been trying to tell them what the formal notions are, and then that would be enough, and they would understand. And now people are recognizing, of course, that that's not enough, that they still have these notions that compete with what we're telling them. And they aren't always able to reconcile those notions by the end of a class. So I think in that sense, the scaffolding and the feedback is still really important at the college level, even though they are a little bit older. One thing you might be able to do is shift the burden of some of that to outside of class time and make them do more of it on their own, because there's a higher expectation of independent learning in college than there probably is in, you know, elementary school level.
Yeah, that was something that I've thought about a lot, too, as of, well, I mean, and I guess in regard to statistics, like at the high school level, they have sometimes a whole year, or at least every day during a semester, to do introductory statistics versus a semester at college, and, you know, three. But, you know, I guess with the time, there are other trade-offs, because there are some advanced placement courses out there that really aren't that very good at the high school level, so the extra time doesn't necessarily do that much. So I think that is an interesting kind of a question, too, is, you know, how is that time used? What factor does it play? I mean, I think that the outside of class study groups are a huge, you know, factor with successful undergraduates, that outside of class or the additional processing time that they get from those. And I'm about to send that one article out, too. It should be coming through in just a second.
Do you require outside study groups? Does anybody require them? Or commuter campus? Our students usually come and leave. They don't stay.
Say my school is primarily a commuter campus as well, so we don't really have a lot of study groups done as well.
We don't require study groups here, but you could require other things, you know, like you could require a certain amount of either reading or looking at, you know, an activity or an athlete or something like that outside of class time, and then have students prepared to come and discuss during class time. So you could kind of, you know, shift the burden in that sense, almost in a way moving more to like a hybrid type course where they have to do a certain amount of the learning on their own, however they get it, whether they're studying with friends formally or informally, or whether they're looking at things online or reading the textbook. But then they have to have all that prepared to come into class, so that class can be more discussion and, you know, synthesis and exploration than, like, lecture.
Do you do that? I've done that with one of my other courses. I've not done it with statistics, because when I ask them to read before, they always come in with, well, I didn't understand anything. I've done it with guided reading questions with, like, my nursing math class and other classes, and it's been successful. I haven't found much success in statistics with it.
I have never done it, so I can't, you know, I've always been a part of a class where there's this vague expectation that you're supposed to read the textbook before you come to class, but no one ever does it, and we never check them on it. So I don't know how it would work in statistics.
Yeah, I think there comes a problem in with, you know, do you have a statistics textbook that's a friendly read? You know, some
right.
textbooks are, they are difficult to read, and unless you're good at reading a, you know, a more mathematically inclined textbook, you know, students do get frustrated. And I love the book I chose for my classes, DeVoe, and the reason I chose it was because it was so readable. You know, students can actually sit down and read it, and it's got, like, a real conversational tone, and but I've, you know, looked through tons of other stat textbooks, and I don't know which ones you guys use, but they are, you know, it's technical reading. It's the kind of thing where you can't just sit and, you know, read it like a novel. You have to kind of go back, and you have to look at examples, and, you know, that is a lot harder for a lot of students to have that much discipline to sit and, you know, really sit and absorb the material, whereas, you know, reading for, like, an English class, you can kind of sit and just, you know, read the chapter and, you know, just sort of sit and think about it. You don't have to really engage. I don't know. I was never a big English person, so I might be speaking out of turn, but.
Has anyone ever seen, I've never seen a piece of research like this or a paper, but I was just wondering, now that you mentioned that, like a reading comprehension kind of a perspective on students, ability to read books, because, I mean, we pick up books and we think that, you know, one is much better written than another, but I'm just wondering, like, how students perceive the traditional texts or how they understand or process the traditional texts versus, you know, some of the others. There was a presentation at MAA, like, 2 or 3 years ago when we did a presentation there, and someone was working on that kind of thing with mathematics texts. I never saw any publications come out of that, but that kind of ties in with the whole language angle, too, and students' understanding of statistical language. But anyway, that, you know, I don't know if anyone had seen that or not, but kind of an interesting, it would be an interesting project to pair up with someone that's a reading educator.
Yeah, I don't think I haven't ever seen anything.
Yeah, I certainly haven't.
Me either.
And I guess maybe my opinion on the activities and, like, how much you should make them do outside of class. I one time took a workshop that was before classes began, and it was on group-based learning. And the idea was to really have them reading all the stuff outside of class. And they would come in the day of class, and they would take an individual test. And then they would take a group-based test to see if they could, like, basically explain the ideas to each other. And then within the rest of the time, basically doing activities and that type of stuff to help address the ideas. But it wasn't directed toward any specific discipline when I took this workshop. And I kind of always thought in my mind, how on earth can I do this in statistics class, because they don't ever read the textbook. I don't know if they ever understand the textbook. And so I always thought that would be easier to apply in many other disciplines, but I didn't know how to do it in my own either.
I think there's two problems. You know, I think one is, like Lee was saying, there's this issue of they are very technical, and so students struggle with that. And it usually, I don't think they read textbooks. You know, they get the homework problems out of the back, and then if they need a definition, they'll flip to the definition. If they maybe need an example, they'll try and look for an example. And that's really it. That's all they'll do. But I think then the other side of that is, you know, I also don't think as a discipline really has so much required them to read the book, because we lecture on what's in the book. You know, we don't assume they've read and go the next step and say, well, now we're going to discuss and extend and apply, or apply and extend. We lecture first. So they really have no reason to read the book. They can get it in a somewhat more user-friendly format in lecture, hopefully. So maybe it requires a bit of a shift in the way we kind of all think to make it work in a stats class.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'm pretty bad about making that assumption that, you know, I don't assume that they read the book.
So I just did a Google search on reading math textbooks, and certainly got, I wouldn't say I got, at least so far I haven't gotten any research, but certainly links to other places and resources of people trying to give advice on how to read math. I mean, there was something in the American Mathematical Monthly on teaching and testing mathematics reading. So I think that there are. So I mean, I did not do the same search on statistics, but there may be similar things.
Yeah. You know, I think that Joan Garfield and Andy Ziffler have had some success with getting students to read the textbook in their AIMS course. Are you guys familiar with their AIMS curriculum for intro stats?
Yeah, I am.
It's basically, I have absolutely no idea what the acronym stands for. But I probably
Adapting Innovative Materials in Statistics.
Oh, I'm impressed. I can never keep all the acronyms straight anymore. But, you know, basically the course, and I've looked at their website a little bit, and I've looked at Andy's syllabus a little bit, and it says right on the syllabus, listen, this is not a traditional class. You don't just come to lecture and listen. You have to read the material. You have to come prepared, and then we're doing activities the whole time. And it really is, you know, I've looked. All of their lesson plans are available online, so if you Google AIM statistics, you can get them all very easily. And I've looked at some of them, and I've incorporated a few into my class, and they really are meant to be more discovery-based and hands-on activities. And I think they've had reasonable success with that course. So I think that's where the idea – I have no idea which textbook they use or if they even just maybe use a compilation of materials without using, like, a single formal textbook. That part I'm not sure about what they do. But in terms of the, you know, expectations of reading, they stated up front that, yes, that reading is an expectation for this course, and I think that they have had success with it. Because what if you make the reading an essential part of coming to class, you're not going to get anything out of class if you haven't done the reading, then I think students will eventually figure out, okay, I need to do this reading.
Right. And I think that there are certainly strategies for, you know, incorporating that the reading assignment, you know, is necessary. I mean, one simple way is to have them that they, you know, they've got to participate in some discussion board around that chapter where you pose some questions and everybody has to kind of participate in that. You know, I mean, so there's electronic ways that you can use the technology to get conversations going about the textbook. But you can also, when they walk in, you have a question ready, you know, that they would only be able to really answer if they read the textbook. And you pose the question, and they have to respond to it and submit it, turn it in. You know, and then you can use that as a springboard for, you know, discussion in the class. And then they pretty quickly get the message, oh,
yeah,
I don't come prepared reading this, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be successful in either getting my assessment points that I need and or participating. You know, I know at least with one of the things that I do in my doctoral level classes as far as reading articles, I mean, they've got to come in and they're separated in different groups and different people get kind of randomly assigned to be an expert on different sections of an article or an article on its own, and they have to be ready to lead a discussion, and they never know which part they're going to be assigned to.
Yeah, I definitely think they need, you know, I mean, with students, there always have to kind of be a little bit of a carrot at the end of the stick to kind of, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Get them going in the right direction.
And for them to realize not just the carrot, but I think for them to, I think initially it starts off with a carrot, but I think, you know, for them to really see that there is a true connection between the reading and the class activities.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just perceived that, well, you're supposed to read the textbook so you've got this background information so I don't have to discuss it in class, then they quickly learn a perception that it's not well connected with what you expect of them in class.
Yeah, I think it's important for them too. You know, I think sometimes it's easy to forget that they're taking a lot of other classes and they're doing a lot of other things.
Yep.
And so if there is really no connection and no value, then you can't really fault them for not doing it. It's just,
right.
On one case, you can kind of make the argument that it's good time management for them.
Exactly.
If they can survive without reading the textbook, why on earth should they take the time to read the rather dense, obtuse textbook?
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate way, I guess, to force them into reading the text is to have a completely online course, you know, that it's completely text-based. That, it'll be interesting to see, I think, how much those take off in the next decade or so, because, I mean, our students, they do seem to not really, a lot of them anyway, seem to want to come to class and learn what they need to learn, and, you know, the outside reading may or may not get done, but, you really have no choice online. Although then the reading time also takes the place of the time that you would spend going to the course and sitting there, too, but I don't know. I did find, I did a little bit of digging on the reading comprehension thing, too, on the ERIC website, and there's one, I haven't read it yet, but it was in Educational Studies in Mathematics in 2006. It's titled Characterizing Reading Comprehension of Mathematical Texts.
Huh.
And they did some things with 95 upper secondary and university students, and they gave them some tests of prior knowledge, and they compared how they read mathematics textbooks with how they read history textbooks. And then the conclusion of the abstract just says the findings suggest that there's a need for more explicit teaching of reading comprehension for texts, including symbols. So I'll go ahead and send that one out too. The Educational Studies in Mathematics actually has all of their content online for free for like the next couple of months. So
good to know.
Yeah, it's just kind of, I mean, I'm surprised they've got everything like back to. I've gone back some like back into the 80s, and they've got the full text. I think they might have everything scanned and posted online. It's like, you know, if I had the time, I would go and download all of it and burn it to disk. But, yeah, it's all there.
Yeah. I mean, our university has electronic access. Are you sure that you're not accessing it through Salisbury and getting...
I'm at home on my own internet connection.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I got an email about it, too, a couple of weeks ago that they're... having this deal, I think it's like through mid-October, where the content is all just free online.
Uh-huh. Well, I would definitely recommend, for those of you that don't read in Ed Studies a lot, to go and take a look through there. I think you'll find lots of different relevant, typically pretty easy to read articles.
Okay, is there any more discussion about that, or do we want to talk about the next paper?
Seems like we should go on, given the time.
Okay. All right, so looking at the one by Benzie and Garfield and Ziffler, anything in particular stand out, anyone that we haven't already discussed with the other paper?
I have this one on page 478 under the specific suggestions. It got a lot at the order that you should be teaching. Like, students should not be introduced formally to statistical terms before they've done exploratory data analysis. There is something in here that you shouldn't introduce the vocabulary and that it's important to focus on the big ideas of statistics. I don't remember where I saw it. There was something in here, like, you shouldn't just go in and teach them vocabulary.
There's something about that on number 2 on page 479. I don't know if that's what you're... it might have been in the general text, too, somewhere. But number 2 says it's important to focus on the big ideas of statistics, such as distribution sample, rather than learning definitions and practicing skills and procedures.
Yeah, I have it highlighted. Somehow I missed it. I was staring at the page, and right there. Yeah, that's what I thought. I really liked this one, actually. It had a lot of...
And I think that is, isn't that, I mean, there's kind of a version of that in the guy's guidelines, isn't there? A kind of an idea of that statement, or maybe I'm remembering that wrong.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah. I think you are right. I haven't looked at it since last year, but yes, I think you're right.
And I think that's what they're trying to do, Harla, to go back to the AIMS. You know, I think that's what they're trying to do with AIMS and what they're trying to do, you know, because it's the same people, well, sort of the same people.
Yeah.
Garfield and Ziffler. You know, trying to... And I don't know how much they really do with definitions and things and AIMS. I mean, I'm sure they do, but, you know.
Well, I've looked at some of their lessons, and at least in the early lessons, it seems like the definitions are really defined in context. Like, in the process of an activity, they'll talk about something, and then they'll introduce the idea of the population in the context of that activity, and then do a general abstraction of kind of what population means. Which is in direct contrast to my notes where I had the little, you know, nice box definition that said the population is the large group that you are interested in learning about, and then went into examples that said, you know, gave the context and said, what's the population in this case? So I think they really do try and do more of a just-in-time and a more within context. And I think that also connects back to that point that kind of stuck out for me in the other article about using the definitions and the math to model the real world as opposed to relegating the real world to an example. I think the language thing here is very similar. It's this idea of, you know, let them approach it through discovery, and then you try and take what they already have and shape it and mold it and get it going in the right direction.
It sounds like it's similar, I don't know, maybe it's not, it's similar to the reformed way you teach algebra. You introduce an application problem, you use that to work back to the theory and all the context of it, and then you go back to applications again, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Not as familiar with the algebra.
So yeah, I haven't taught algebra, so.
Yeah. Or calculus also. It was a reform effort from a long time ago for math.
Hmm.
Well, that was a conversation stopper, sorry.
Algebra and calculus, that just cuts off the conversation.
Well, I did go into statistics for a reason, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, we have people here who do that really well with algebra. I would think it would be really easy to do it with statistics. Start from the context, work back.
Well, really, it seems to make sense. Like, you can almost, you know, start a class, like a kind of a real-world example, and be like, okay, how else could we answer this question? And then, ooh, let's teach about how we could answer this question, and then go back.
But I'm like you, Harl. I give the definition, and then I give them the examples.
Yeah. I think that part of that stems from the fact that, you know, for us, we learned really well from that mode of instruction, and it made sense to us, and even if we didn't have a great teacher, we were able to kind of put together the pieces and, you know, resynthesize things, and we can organize them in a way that they make sense. But, you know, I think the fact that we are all in higher education is indicative of some form of selection bias. You know, we learned well from the system. That's why we're kind of now leading the system. And I think that's one of the things that makes it hard to change. It's habit. It worked for us. We have to give up some sense of control.
And I'd like to emphasize that it worked for you because of the, and I'm included in that. It worked for us because of what we were held accountable for knowing. But if we want, if someone really asks you some conceptual something conceptual about algebra or calculus, you actually may not, even though you made it through the system, may not really have a good grasp of something really underlying, a particular concept.
Yeah, I suppose that's
true. I know I find that with myself all the time. I mean, as I've grown as a math educator and I start looking at different content areas, I'm relearning and really trying to go deeper in a lot of the topics that I was successful at, but I didn't really have a good grasp on as far as deep understanding.
Yeah, I've told, other teachers and other people the story that, even though I'm in statistics education, first time I took statistics, I did not understand the central limit theorem. I could get through a problem on a test. I didn't understand the concept of repeated sampling and the distribution of the mean or the distribution of the – I didn't understand any of that until I got into the second course, and it was sort of a computer-based course, and we were doing a lot of labs and actually analyzing some data that I actually finally got it. So because the first course was very much just sort of a sit in a lecture, take notes, do problems, kind of, regular course we all kind of went through. We didn't do any of this concept-based type of stuff that we're trying to now approach. And, it is. It's amazing how much I missed the first time around that I don't realize until, I didn't realize until later on. And then the little light bulb went off, and it's like, oh, okay. That's why we did that. So, anyway, sorry. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
So what did you all think about the methodology of a teaching experiment?
I think it sounds extremely labor-intensive.
It is.
Yes, it is.
We were, when we first got on the call and we were all just kind of chit-chatting, we were all commenting on how we feel like we're already at, 90 miles an hour in various things that we're doing, and having to really go through each lesson and critically evaluate each lesson and use that to get your next lesson going. I mean, I teach Tuesday, Thursday, so that gives me basically Wednesday when I would have to go through and evaluate everything and come with the new lesson. And it seems a little scary, especially in light of the other responsibilities that we all have. I certainly see the value of it, and I think it's really intriguing, and I think it's something that's, I'm sure, very good for the students. But, yeah, it's a little scary.
Yeah. And honestly, the way that I tend to make it work whenever I do teaching experiments is you build it in where you've got release from other courses, so that's the only course that you're doing. You've got, research funds and research money, so you've got graduate students to be part of a team. And you really basically plan your life for that semester or that portion of the semester. And you don't make any other obligations. And but you're right, they're very, very labor intensive.
Holly Lynn, when you've done them before, do you have to get student permission to videotape in the classroom?
Yes, you do.
What if you have a student in your class who won't give you permission?
Then I place them outside of the camera view. And I have had that happen. The same thing where, I ask them to give me access to the work that they complete as part of their assignment so that I could use it for research, and they have the option to allow me access to that or not for research purposes. So, of course, I get access to it. If I'm the classroom teacher, I get access to it for grading, but I can't necessarily – if they don't sign the form, then I can't use it for research purposes. But I've also done a lot of work where, I'm not necessarily the teacher. Somebody else is the instructor of record. And so, they're giving me access as a researcher to the assignments rather than just the instructor. But you have to have a team in place to do it because it is so labor intensive. And I think it works best if you don't try to do it for the whole semester. If you pick a portion, you know, a unit, and you say, okay, that's, I'm going to try to plan out a trajectory through this that's going to take maybe, you know, a couple weeks, depending on the chunk size of what you're, you know, the concepts that you're going after. But to try to do it for, and that's typically what I've done. I mean, I think the longest teaching experience that I've done in a university classroom lasted 6 weeks. I don't try to do it the whole semester. I just can't physically do it.
Well, I guess myself, I, you know, how it talks about kind of feel like I do my own little mini teaching experiments every time it's the new time I'm teaching the class for the first time. Because I mean, I love to try to plan ahead. I've always been a planner, but when it's my first time teaching the class, you have no idea how it's going to go, how well are the students going to be receptive to this way of teaching something. And so I kind of feel like, I mean, a lot of times we're probably doing little ones in our own head. We're just not doing it very formally.
Yeah. I think that's true. Even with statistics, we have small classes at my college, and I always, you know, I'll ask them what they still aren't getting and then revise lessons based on that. I mean, it's kind of a mini experiment. I revise my lessons. I don't do it every day this semester, but usually I'll go back to what they're having trouble with and I'll just revise my lessons to cover more of that type of material.
Right. So one of the advantages, I mean, so, you know, planning in between lessons and reflecting on your lessons is certainly a natural part of what you do. And what you have to do is build in the time that it's now a more public activity, that it's not just a private, you know, something that you're privately doing, but you're doing it as part of a team and gaining the perspectives of everyone else. And sometimes it also means, as a teacher, if you're the teacher, if you're playing a role as a teacher and a researcher, of being willing to engage in those conversations not as a critique and criticism of your teaching, but of the way that something happened to play out in class, and to, you have to let your defenses down. And that can be hard. Hmm. And then you watch the videotape and go, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that.
I just need to jump in real quick to let you know I need to run. I'll check in on the website, though, to see what the readings are. And as far as schedule, my schedule is pretty wide open when you talk about the time for the next phone call, because I'm still on sabbatical this semester. So I need to get going, but I'll check in on it. So talk to you later.
Randy, are you going to PME&A?
No, not this year. I won't be there. I do want to get to one within the next couple of years, though I haven't been for a while. But, yeah, I do want to try to get to one of those again. So.
Yeah, well, that's where I'll be next week. So just wanted to see if you were going.
Did you already send out the papers to Randy?
Yes, he did.
Should be two emails that came through with the two papers. And if anyone didn't get those, just let me know and I can resend them.
I don't have anything in my mailbox, that's why I was just asking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I got both of them, so it just may take a little bit to come through.
I have both of them, too.
Okay. All right, good to talk to you. See you later.
Randy.
Bye, Randy.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, so was anything sparked from some of the readings that got you interested in going forward for stuff for next week? Or next time?
I don't know if there was anything specific. On some hand, I feel like the more we read, the bigger the problem feels.
Yeah, I feel like
we're getting
wider instead of narrower. Yeah.
Okay, so let's revisit. What do you think the problem is? What's the problem you're trying to focus on?
Well, I think where we had started back in the beginning, like back at USCOTS, was the idea of, one of the things we had talked about was the idea of, do students understand why we're taking a sample and what we're doing with it. Like, do students really understand that very beginning, like, of inference? So nothing about any of the technical pieces about how to do inference, but do they understand why the inference is taking place? Why we're taking the sample and what the goal is? And so I think, you know, the first article that we discussed today, the Schwartz article, certainly had some interesting perspectives on sampling and people's understanding and kind of faith in samples.
Yeah, and I thought today's article, I think, was really in that direction, or talking about that problem specifically. I don't know, maybe there's something in the references that I'm just trying to look through, see if there's anything that...
There's the first one. What features make samples seem representative?
Yeah, 1980.
Yes, 1980.
Yeah, when was this chapter written?
At least I was alive. Barely, but I was alive.
So one of the other things that trying to think of some of the other themes that have come up over the last couple conversations is this idea of the usefulness of probability for statistical inference.
Yeah.
And there is a... there's a book chapter by Maxine, and I always pronounce her name wrong, Phaneuk, and I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, but it's P-F.
Like P-F, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That one.
I
know the last name because I saw it come up a bunch, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't exactly know how she pronounces it. But in this, the book chapter is about, from her perspective, what probability is needed to really understand statistical inference. So that might be a possible candidate chapter. I think it came out in a 2005 book. And I have that book. The book is at home, but I could bring it in next week and scan it if that's something that people get see as interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
There's
I think that's been
a... work by Jane Watson and some of her colleagues on... understanding of sampling, particularly kind of like sampling and variation studies kind of combined together. But all of these, so a lot of the studies that I certainly am familiar with come from middle school and high school studies. I'm just not as well versed in the papers and studies that have been written about introductory statistics.
Well, I wonder to some extent if we could, you know, that may actually provide something of a springboard for our research. We can look at what's been done in middle and high school, and then as we start to, you know, narrow topics, we can look then, is there anything out there in introductory stat? And if not, that may be a place for us to start to look.
Yeah, that's right.
Some place where we can kind of complement the existing literature that's out there.
Right.
Well, maybe one of the things we could do for next month is all of us could, because we haven't really, like, done our own searches. I don't think any of us have really been looking much for things. Maybe we could start to, you know, use the literature search on CauseWeb and, you know, start to try and put a list together of articles maybe on those two particular topics that you just mentioned, you know, the usefulness of probability and inference and, or talking about probability issues and inference and the idea of the sample. Man, my brain is just not working.
I think that's a great idea.
So.
Yeah. Should we split up two and two? Two of us take sampling, two of us take probability?
I'd actually suggest a different strategy where perhaps maybe on Google Docs that you start a document that, you know, has these two categories.
Oh, okay.
And... you go out and you do some of your own searches in, you know, one or the other, and you start, you know, when you find a reference that you think might be good, you throw it in that document.
Holly Lynn?
Yes.
You said that we should also be looking at research methodology, so should we have that as a third category?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So some of the other type of methodologies that you should probably want to try to get familiar with, because realistically, doing a teaching experiment, you know, you all don't have a support team at each of your universities. So even though we have a support team with each other, it would just be very, very difficult to do that via distance. So I think that type of methodology is just not going to work. So other types of methodologies are thinking about doing so how to use things like interviews, how to do what's called a task-based interview, if you want to interview students, being able to do kind of mixed methodologies where you may be, you know, constructing tasks that they're doing both. So some of this is more kind of as far as analysis strategies of how you, if you get students' work, how do you develop codes and how do you apply coding systems to your data. And I'm not quite sure if we want to get into all that right yet. But I think if you can, so maybe one strategy is finding some articles in these two categories, and then as you read through the abstracts, trying to take note of what methodologies they're using.
Mm. Okay.
I like that idea.
Yeah. Do we want to have something to read for next time in addition to doing this, or do we want to maybe?
Well, it could be that it's not just going and finding references, but it could be that everyone has to find. I'm just going to make up a number. Everybody has to contribute five items to this list, and not only do you contribute the reference, but you have to provide a summary of it. And so you have to at least, you know, not necessarily read it for comprehension, but read it enough to be able to describe kind of what the article is about, the methodology that's being used in it, if it's a research study. Because some of the papers you might be more kind of position or description papers, not necessarily a study. And so that you're building kind of an annotated bibliography.
Okay.
So I made up the number 5. That may be too ambitious.
I mean, you
may find 15, but you know, you really only want to contribute some really good ones.
Maybe 3. I heard somebody say 3.
I think 3 is reasonable.
Sort of as a starting point. I mean, if you more,
add
you know.
Randy and I in that we've got to each find 3, and provide kind of a summary of it, then, you know, by a month from now, we have a nice collection of, what would that be? There's, what, 6 of us? So 18, you know, close to 20 articles.
Yeah.
And I think let's not restrict us as far as going in one category or another, because one category may be more fruitful than the other.
Yeah.
Maybe that will help us narrow in.
Right.
Which category we like or we think we can pursue.
Yeah, like, oh, there's not much done on this. Let's go there.
Yeah. So then when should we try and have this all done by?
Okie dokie.
So let's see, 4 weeks.
We're looking in October now.
15th of October. If we're looking 4 weeks, so I'd probably at least want to give us that long, right?
Yeah.
And do you all
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that.
I'm saying 4 weeks from today would be the 15th of October, and I'm guessing we at least went that long.
Yes.
And I don't know if you all have fall break.
Oh, yeah, that's going
to
be fall break.
So if you are willing to be there during fall break.
We don't have off till Thanksgiving.
Okay. Because my fall
sorry
break
to hear that.
Is the 20th, but I can come in. That's not a problem for me at all. Probably be working anyway.
I'm thinking for me, later in the month would be better. I'm actually going to be gone the entire week of the 12th to the 16th. So certainly nothing probably like immediately after that week. I might need some time to kind of regroup and stuff like that when I get back. So maybe either later the next week or even the last week in October.
Yeah, I was going to put a vote in for the 22nd, which is the Thursday of that next week, because the 27th is the activity webinar, although I can do two things in one day. I wouldn't be able to do it during the activity webinar. And then...
could make for an interesting webinar.
And then Thursday, I'm assuming we're kind of going with Tuesdays and Thursdays, right? Although we don't have to do Tuesdays and Thursdays, although...
I believe Carrie's schedule's better then.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. 29th, I could do earlier on the 29th. Because I have to go, I'm going to the Ohio Math Conference like that night. There's a banquet, so I'd be driving up. But actually, it's not that far away, so... during the day.
On the 29th, I'll be actually at a conference the 28th, 29th, 30th.
All right. So,
but, I mean, I think it's more important for the four of you to make it. If there are times when one of Randy or I can't be there, and it sounds like he can pretty much be there.
Yeah. I'm thinking, so in terms of me, my objection to the beginning of the week is, you know, I just don't want to be gone a week and then, like, on Monday come back. And trying to do a conference call. But I would say, like, Wednesday the 21st, hopefully I'll be back together by then. So what about any time between, like, the 21st and, say, the 27th?
I teach from 8 to 6:30 on Wednesdays, and I only have, like, a half an hour break, so I can't do Wednesdays.
Okay.
How about Thursday the
27th? Thursday I teach from 8 until 2, so I could do after 2.
So is this time from 3 to 4 on the
22nd?
Is that what I'm hearing?
That would work for me.
That would work for me.
Me too.
All right.
And that gives us, I think, 5 weeks instead of 4. So.
So we are going to try to find 3 articles and post these to some sort of Google document. Does someone know how to do that?
Don't we have a Google group started?
Yeah, we got a Google group.
Just put it out there instead.
Okay.
I think somebody just has to start a document.
Okay.
And then we can all go in and edit it.
I'm not tech savvy. and then we're going to write a little, like, summary of it. Do we want to each pick one of the ones that we found so we could talk about it in more detail on the...
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, maybe have, like, one prepared for discussion.
Like, one that you actually read in a lot more detail and you...
yeah.
Want to highlight maybe important things about it or what you didn't like about it, also, possibly.
Sounds good to me.
I think that sounds really good. So then what about our jobs for next time? If we all move down one, I think that makes Lee organizer,
yep.
Tara moderator, Jackie synthesizer, and me recorder. Does that match everybody else's tally? Or am I off?
I'm doing what I think I should be doing. How's that?
Yeah, I think I'm good. So... if 3 of the 4 are good, that would make the 4th good.
Okay.
I hope so. And just as a little sidebar, Lee and I, and this is Jackie, are friends on Facebook. So any of the rest of you are on Facebook, maybe another nice way to communicate.
I have yet to make a Facebook account, but I'm thinking I'm going to have to break down it.
How do I get on it?
I was just thinking it'd be kind of... you know, nice to have another way of communicating with each other and also maybe just getting to know each other, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you don't have enough to do Hurla, you know.
I know. I still haven't created my, like, personal department webpage, and my department head emailed me about it the other day. I'm like, oh, okay. I'll get around to that. So I'll do that and create my Facebook account all in the same day. Or maybe I'll just link to my Facebook account from the department page.
All right,
so then I think we're set. So I guess I will type up some brief, can't say that word, brief synthesis of what we talked about.
And I will. I promise I will get the recorded notes up earlier than, like, 4 weeks from now. So
that's fine.
Yeah.
Lee?
Yeah?
Since our call got cut off, do I have to let Gene know that we'll have two separate recordings?
Yeah, no, Justin can go in and get both of them, so it's fine.
Okay.
I'm sure, as long as you recorded both of them, it won't be a big deal, I don't think.
All right.
So.
Sounds good.
And let's hope not, because I didn't take as detailed notes as I probably should have. But, so.
I had to listen to the recording last time to do notes. It was very helpful.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, but I'll get all that up hopefully over the weekend, actually. So, you know, I'll just watch some football and record statistics notes. So, very exciting weekend.
Sounds good.
Yep. All right.
All right. Jackie, I hope your boy is okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to go get him.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, hopefully everyone will enjoy their weekend and de-stress a little bit. You know, relax.
Go down to 5 miles an hour.
I was going for 60.
Yes.
We said speed limit. Come on.
Yeah.
All right, ladies. I'm out of here.
All right.
Bye.
All
right.
Take care, everybody.
Everyone.
All right. Bye.
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 Is everyone gone?
Thank you. Please stand by.